You're listening to Civic Media. You can tune into any of our live shows on any radio station across the state with the Civic Media app. Find us in your phone's app store and listen anytime, anywhere.
Welcome, everybody. I'm Maggie Dawn, and you are listening to the Civic Media Radio Network. Happy Thursday afternoon. Well, the news keeps getting worse for U.S. consumers. U.S. shoppers are now apparently seeing order cancellation as the world shuts down some American-bound shipments. Yeah, you know those companies like Temu where you can get the stuff for like nearly free, so you might order every day? Yeah, that kind of stuff. It's all about the de minimis exception. We've got a great expert to help us understand that. Want to share some other news of the day with you as some context here as well. We are now looking at tariffs across the board at the highest levels we've ever seen. Well, not ever seen, but in modern American economic history. Right now, U.S. aluminum prices are 50% higher than in Europe and Japan, which puts U.S. manufacturers like the ones in the state of Wisconsin at an enormous competitive disadvantage. There are examples of these throughout our economy right now. And today, Vice President J.D. Vance went to La Crosse, Wisconsin, in a steel manufacturing plant and lied to people there. Interesting, that's not what I would call town hall style, right? More of a rally, if you will. But Congress people and senators across the country are having a bit of a problem at some of these town halls. One such congressman really ran into it of his own making. We're going to call this one the old Freudian slip, where you say the quiet part out loud. Take a listen to this. This is Representative Mark Alford, a Republican from Pennsylvania, just a couple days ago. Ouch. Take a listen.
Today, here's the problem. I kind of have to disprove a negative in that come January. Ma'am, did you want to yell something back there? Stand up.
Hi.
Okay, if you didn't want to hear my lies, why did you come here? All right?
Oopsies.
If you don't want to hear anything I say, why did you come here? All right?
Oopsies. Yeah, we can wrap that clip. because people are really upset about the state of the economy, very nervous, especially going into the holiday season and back to school. We've got an expert to help us understand it all. Thank you so much for letting me get through that introduction. His name is Alex Yaquez. He's the chief of policy and advocacy at the Groundwork Collaborative. He's also a former member of the White House National Economic Council. Welcome, Alex, and thanks so much for being here.
Thanks so much for having me, Maggie.
So Groundwork Collaborative has got a report that you recently published specifically talking about back-to-school prices. We're going to put a link to that report in our show notes today so folks can go look at your great work themselves. Again, you can find our show notes wherever you get our podcasts, civicmedia.us, Spotify, Apple Pods. But tell us what some of the top-line conclusions your report reached, Alex.
Sure. So we put out recently a report with our partners at the Century Foundation that took a look at actually one of our own staff members' child's back to school shopping list. We matched it up with scanner data from Nielsen, which allowed us to compare what specific branded items cost now versus weeks ago versus last year. And then, you know, we totaled up all of the other impacts that Trump's economic policies, including the GOP budget law, which Vice President Vance was in Wisconsin attempting to rebrand earlier today, his tariff policy and all the rest, put them together to take a look at how a family that is trying to put kids through school, send kids off to college, and just, you know, do the basics, get the textbooks, the notepads, the pencils, get the lunches packed and folks off to school, how much more they're going to have to pay from last year.
Yeah, the numbers here, Alex, are deeply concerning. And last week, I had on Benga Adjelore, another economist. We were talking about the Walmart earnings call, which you have to decode. Benga and I spent some time decoding these earnings calls. And one of the things that we wanted to show people is that even Walmart, the world's largest retailer, with the most leverage of any company that sells retail products to U.S. consumers, is saying they are now passing along the cost of Trump's tariffs to customers, and they are seeing customers adjust their buying behavior. when we look at the holiday time and back to school, a lot of this stuff, especially for back to school, this is not really negotiable. Where are folks making up the difference? Can they make up their difference in household budgets?
That's right. And I think that what we're seeing so far is that parents are expected to spend less on back to school. It's like Donald Trump said, he said, you know, parents can maybe buy only one pencil instead of five. They don't need five pencils. They can just get one. They can just have one doll instead of 10. And that's where we're seeing this consumer spending pull back, and we're seeing that economy wide. But if you look at items like binders, like composition notebooks, like pocket folders, scissors, these items are up to 40% year over year. And the main reason is because these are low cost, mass produced products that almost exclusively come from China. Even if Trump's tariffs were meant to bring back strategic manufacturing in the US, we are simply not setting up pencil factories in the United States. And so there is no real alternative but to raise prices on many of these items. And that's what we're seeing, where the cost of the inflation on back to school items, again, a lot of these imported items from China in particular, are up three times what the headline rate of inflation is. And we expect they're only going to get more expensive, and the holidays are going to be even worse.
Yeah, it's not looking good. We're going to get to the de minimis exemption in just a second, but explain to people, there are sort of two categories of goods that we're going to experience a lot of pain in. One, to use coffee, it's the easiest example. We're not manufacturing coffee in the United States because our climate doesn't permit it. We always have to import it, so your coffee is getting more expensive. There are other goods like that. There's another category of products like pencils and index cards and very, very more inexpensive, mass-produced, systematized. You can only make money when you sell these things at massive scale. Why is it that that kind of manufacturing is never coming back here?
What I would say is that we want more high-value manufacturing, more high-skilled manufacturing. The wages that these sectors pay just are not competitive with other jobs in the economy. Contrast this with manufacturing of, say, electric vehicle batteries or semiconductors or some of these high-value, high-innovation, economically valuable industries that in the Biden administration, we had tried to ensure that we were producing here in the United States, and we're quite successful at doing so. We use tariffs as part of that strategy to make sure that we could protect from competitors in other countries who were using, you know, unfair methods to undercut our producers. This is not what Donald Trump is doing. His tariffs are broad-based. They're indiscriminate. There is no strategy behind them other than make them as wide and as high as possible. And he's hitting not just the pencils and the index cards and the binders, of which we are not bringing back here to the United States, but also many of the inputs that go into that higher value manufacturing. So not only is he not incentivizing companies to bring production back here at scale, he's also making it more expensive for many of our manufacturers who actually do produce in the U.S. and export elsewhere, but source many of their components overseas.
Yeah, this is one of those, like, the eight-headed beasts, right? There are so many different elements of the economy where we see these cascading impacts. The net result of this is very likely to be some kind of economic slowdown, particularly in certain sectors that are highly reliant on these relationships. What I've heard from farmers especially is that the consumers of some of our agricultural and other complex manufacturing products, if the abroad consumer stops buying our soybeans and establishes a relationship with, say, Brazil, they're never reestablishing, or it is highly unlikely because of the extraordinary transaction costs to reestablish purchaser and consumer supply chains with different countries' producers. Those aren't coming back. This will end up killing businesses, will it not, Alex?
It absolutely will. And I think that's what you're seeing so far. You said it's likely we'll see an economic slowdown. It's already here. Right. We had revisions to GDP, which that came out yesterday on their headline, this morning, on their headline looked okay. 3.3% GDP growth in this quarter compared to a negative 0.5 retraction last quarter. But if you peek under the hood, a lot of this is driven by the ups and downs of imports, right? And so under the hood, if you look at core GDP, this is essentially slowing down from quarter one to quarter two, and it's well below where it was last year. So the slowdown is here, and it's hitting the manufacturing sector, which has lost jobs for each of the last 3 months. It's hitting the investment in manufacturing construction. And as you mentioned, it's hitting farmers. We see fertilizer prices are higher than they have been any time since Russia's invasion of Ukraine. Manufacturing equipment, the tractors and the farm equipment that farmers use is getting more expensive. And they are not exporting as much, and so, or finding domestic buyers. So their sales are down, crop prices are depressed. Again, without a coherent strategy for what this trade policy is supposed to accomplish, we're just getting broad-based pain across the board.
Broad-based pain. And the thing that is really concerning to me as an economist, a non-PhD economist, I always want to be careful there, is this. When we look at innovation, right, as one of the primary drivers of product differentiation and economic growth in this country, when we see economic slowdown like this, when we see markets and industries and those that control capital investments getting a little nervous and constricting, it means less money is going to be spent in research and development, i.e. innovation, i.e. the very thing that helps grow our economy and has helped our economy, frankly, move out of some of the crisis following COVID, as well as the investments from the Biden administration in that very innovation in the form of the CHIPS and Sciences Act. I want to talk about Lisa Cook, the Fed governor that Donald Trump is trying to fire. We may even talk a little bit about Donald Trump, I don't know, seizing intel. I thought that's not what democracies and capitalist governments or economies did. We'll get to all of that next with my special guest, Alec Yaquez, the chief of policy and advocacy at the Groundwork Collaborative. Let's just touch very briefly when we talk about this constriction, this slowdown that's happening, the possible risks of that dual devil stagflation of unemployment increasing and high inflation. We see Jerome Powell saying, you know, maybe we will lower interest rates because we're seeing a little bit of a weakening in the labor markets. When you see Donald Trump attack Fed Governor Cook, Alex, what does that portend when we are seeing broad-based pain?
Trump's attack on the Federal Reserve and on Lisa Cook, I think, are two things. One, illegal, and two, self-defeating. President Trump has said over and over he wants lower interest rates. I'm sure he will try to, again, as the court case plays out, try to replace Governor Cook with somebody handpicked from his administration who will essentially be a yes man or woman, and they will cut rates going forward. But I do not think this is going to have the impact that he wants it to on things like mortgage rates, because as investors, as Wall Street gets more wary about these kinds of decisions, that is going to push interest rates up as people become less confident in the United States monetary system.
Stay tuned. We're going to talk about that Ludnick when we come back in Trump's attacks on the feds with Alex Yaquez. I'm Maggie Dawn. This is the Civic Media Radio Network.
You're listening to Civic Media. Stay up to date on the latest news and information for your local community and Wisconsin by signing up for our free email newsletter. Visit civicmedia.us/email to get started.
Welcome back, everybody. I'm Maggie Dawn. You are listening to The Maggie Dawn Show here on the Civic Media Radio Network. I'm joined this half hour by Alex Yaquez, Chief of Policy and Advocacy at Groundwork Collaborative and a former official on the White House National Economic Council. Thanks so much for sticking around, Alex. Before the break, I was teasing a little bit about this thing that no regular people have heard about called the de minimis exemption and the fact that this is maybe part of what is driving the cancellation of so many consumer orders of products that cheap products that come from abroad. Tell us what the exemption is and what Donald Trump has done to change it.
So the de minimis exemption is essentially an exemption from tariffs on products that are imported into the U.S. that have less than $800 in value. This is how major online retailers, think Amazon, get product in without incurring heavy tariffs where they're imposed. It has also been a source of controversy. The $800 limit was imposed in 2016. In the Biden administration, we had discussions about lowering it or changing it due to the influx of companies like Temu, which are using that exemption to flood the U.S. with cheap goods that sometimes undermine U.S. producers. Donald Trump announced the closure of this loophole after closing it for imports coming from China earlier. It goes into effect this week. And I think in keeping with Donald Trump's style on these kinds of announcements, did about no work in how to actually implement it. So you're seeing international post offices essentially say they won't ship to the U.S. anymore because there's no system in place to actually collect the duties and get them to customs and border protection. And so I expect the rollout of this policy will be extremely tumultuous for consumers, and they will be likely hit with either cancellations or big surprise bills that they hadn't intended on paying.
No plan for implementation. That's what the red hats should say. No plan. A man plan. No plan. I joke, but it is very serious business. It's an absolute insanity, much like all of Donald Trump's tariff policy, that something that would require such meticulous implementation literally had not a whit of forethinking to it. It's stunning to me. I mentioned the Nudnik Lutnik before the break. Of course, I'm talking about Commerce Secretary Howard Lutnik, whom every time he opens his mouth, I am fairly convinced he knows even less than he did the last time I heard him. He was talking about Donald Trump's seizure of 10% of Intel and saying, no, this is capitalism. Government extortion of a private company to turn over a huge percentage of ownership of that company, not temporarily, not because there's some crisis, but to simply hold it in perpetuity, does not sound like capitalism to me. Alex, explain to us what the heck just went on with Intel.
So recently, after Donald Trump essentially accused the Intel CEO of being an agent of the Communist Chinese Party, the Chinese Communist Party, he had him over and into the office where he essentially made a deal that Intel would hand over about 10% of its outstanding equity or of its existing stock, making the U.S. government the largest shareholder in the company. And in return, Donald Trump would say nice things and stop pressuring him to step down and remove pressure from the awards from the Chips and Science Act that was passed under President Biden a couple years ago. Now, I think there are very legitimate reasons why an equity stake by the government might be used to effectuate an industrial policy in times of emergency, like the bailout of GM and Stellantis or Fiat, Chrysler at the time, where the auto industry was going bankrupt and needed support to restructure. Or in the instance of small startup companies that are looking for capital that they can't get in the private markets, and the U.S. believes that there is a legitimate bet and a national or economic security concern going forward, you can see why an injection of equity might make sense for the government to do. Intel, there's not only not been a rationale stated, it doesn't seem like there is any rationale whatsoever for this move. It is not going to help Intel manufacture new leading edge chips. It's not going to help them find customers and may in fact make it more difficult for them to compete with companies like TSMC, which are watching this interaction very closely. It's just another one of these moves that seems to be driven by Donald Trump's own ego. He wants to own personally stakes in these large companies and not driven by any sort of strategy, economic or national security aside.
Alex, how concerned are you about our ability to actually accurately assess economic data And listen, the new guy who has no business running the Bureau of Labor Statistics is not going to be able to like flip a switch and make all of the data bad. And so there was, I think, a little bit of overstatement of the concern. But what we're seeing, whether it's the CDC, right, or the Bureau of Labor Statistics, is that, gee whiz, what's it going to actually, are we going to be able to rely on that data in a year or two or three? What's your long range thinking? What is the Groundwork Collaborative planning? And do we need states, local governments, and universities to step up with other data collection?
I think the answer is I don't know. And that's almost worse than a no, because the uncertainty, what is this data going to look like? Can we trust it? Is it going to be published in the same way and through the same methods at the same times as it has been? That's going to be the question that everybody is asking. And without it, without high quality data that we can rely on, and the US government produces some of the highest quality economic data, not just in the country, but the world. People, you know, the Federal Reserve, businesses, Wall Street, everybody's flying blind. And so I'm watching this very carefully. I'm very concerned. I do think we will need to step up our production of data from alternative sources and be vigilant in the government data that's coming out.
Folks, that's Alec Yaquez. He's the Chief of Policy and Advocacy at Groundwork Collaborative. Come back soon, Alex, and let's talk about this data problem, because I have some thoughts as well. Without good data, you always get bad policy. Stay with us.
Thanks, Maggie.
Welcome back, everybody. I'm Maggie Dawn. You are listening to the Civic Media Radio Network. We just confirmed we're going to be joined by sports journalist Mike Clemens at the very end of this hour to talk about the Packers' big trade for Micah Parsons. So you're going to want to stay tuned through that. We'll break it all down for you with Mike Clemens coming up shortly. Right now, I want to talk about how bad things are getting at some of our most critical federal agencies. Because over the last 24 hours, one could say that the CDC has imploded. The Centers for Disease Control, you know, the agency that if we had an Ebola outbreak in the United States, or swine flu, it would be the CDC that would be charged with coordinating our nation's response to try to save Americans' lives. And RFK, a conspiracy theorist who said during his confirmation hearings that you shouldn't look to him for medical advice, has pushed out the head of the CDC, which has led to mass resignations. He's been laying off tons of staff. There was a shooting at the CDC, to which Donald Trump has yet to respond. He is gutting one of the agencies that is so critically necessary to protect all of our health. So forget, I don't want to have another argument about this vaccine or that vaccine. Can we all agree that the world is better because we have vaccines, that fewer kids die because we've got vaccines, that, you know, we've gotten healthier? For crying out loud, we had declared measles eradicated. It's not now. Just look to northern Wisconsin, where more measles cases have been uncovered. I think there's 5 diagnosed cases. And I'm going to talk more about the CDC, because one of the people that resigned yesterday wrote a resignation letter that I think every single American should read. And I'm going to read portions of it to you. But I also wanted to point this out. And this is getting less press because of everything that has been happening with the CDC and, of course, the Federal Reserve. But this also happened. The Trump administration has loosened critical food safety standards. At the same time, the FDA is looking to contain a new outbreak of a flesh-eating parasite. I can't make this up. They're like, oh, you know, it's all right if a few people die from foodborne illnesses, parasites, and diseases. I'm sure we should just loosen those standards and fire more people, more of the inspectors that go to our meat processing plants. They're already overwhelmed. And the new proposed inspection rule that's going to loosen these safety standards, it mainly impacts just three meat processors in the United States. But these three meat processors comprise 60% of all pork sales in the U.S. So that basically, they've got like an oligopoly. And one of these three pork processors is a company called JBS. This is a Brazilian meatpacking giant whose New York Stock Exchange debut, their IPO, was what? Surprise, surprise, just approved by the Trump administration, and who gave the Trump inaugural committee how much? Oh, yeah, $5 million. They've also spent $1.5 million just this year lobbying Congress and the federal government, including the Department of Agriculture. Remember, I started the show by talking about the guy that worked for chemical companies that manufactured PFAS and who was suing the federal government, you know, a few months ago to undo the federal government's rules about PFAS. And now he's in charge of those rules. This is not about public health, safety, and welfare. It's not. It's about distracting people with conspiracy theories, anti-science lies, making us all less healthy, less safe, and dividing us all from within. Because trust me, billionaires will always have very safe pork, very clean water, land that is not riddled with PFAS, and very clean air to breathe. And when they run out of it here because they've turned the world into a garbage dumpster, they'll have their penis rockets to take them to Mars. But I digress. Let me bring us back to where I wanted to focus this afternoon. Over the last 24 hours, the head of the CDC has been fired, as I noted before. There was a back and forth, some of it happening on social media, about whether or not she was fired, whether RFK Jr. could actually fire her. He can't because she was appointed by the president and confirmed by Congress. But in the midst of all of this, four officials, also from the CDC, resigned. They are Dr. Deborah Hoory, the CDC's chief medical officer, Dr. Dimitra Daskalakis, who ran the center that issues vaccine recommendations, Dr. Daniel Jerrigan, who oversaw the center that oversees vaccine safety, and Dr. Jennifer Layden, who led the Office of Public Health Data. Dr. Jerrigan was deeply involved in the agency's response to anthrax, swine flu, and COVID. Dr. Daskalakis worked on the Mpox outbreak. Layden established the COVID Strategic Science Unit, and Dr. Hoory built the agency's opioid response program. Former CDC leaders are appalled. Dr. Mandy Cohen, who ran the agency during the second half of the Biden administration, called the officials, quote, exceptional leaders who have served over many decades and many administrations. Dr. Ann Schuchat, the CDC's principal deputy director until her retirement in May 2021, called them the best of the best. These individuals are physicians, scientists, public health superstars. We should all be scared about the nation's health consistency. What led to this breakdown? Well, the straw that broke the camel's back is the new guidelines on the COVID vaccine, restricting its availability. But that was the straw that broke the camel's back. Mass HHS layoffs and mass layoffs at CDC, restructuring, that was part of this process. Then in June, Kennedy ousted all of the members of the CDC's Advisory Committee on Immunization Practices and replaced them with new appointees, most of whom are vaccine skeptics. Weeks later, that newly constituted committee said that it was going to review the entire childhood immunization schedule. In a commentary article that was published by the Journal of American Medicine, the 17 members who were fired said the abrupt firings, appointment of new members, and reduction of CDC staff dedicated to immunizations, quote, have left the U.S. vaccine program critically weakened, unquote. And before this catastrophe, over the last 24 hours, in May, Kennedy bypassed CDC staff and that committee to say that U.S. health officials would no longer recommend coronavirus vaccines for healthy children and healthy pregnant women. Unbelievable. In response to that earlier announcement in May, Lakshmi, and I'm never going to get this woman's name right, Panagiotakopoulos. Maybe I'm close. Lakshmi Panagiotakopoulos, who led a coronavirus vaccine work group of CDC staff and outside experts, she quit. And then weeks later, Fiona Havers, who oversaw the CDC's respiratory virus data and was in charge of presenting it to that committee, she quit. Then Mr. Kennedy said in the spring he was going to promote vitamin A to combat an outbreak of what? Measles in Texas, and directed the CDC to include it in guidance for caring for patients. Experts say that vitamin A can be beneficial for supportive care after someone has gotten sick from measles, but it is generally used in countries where children are malnourished, and stress it is not a replacement for vaccination. And then there was their collective response to a shooting at the CDC, which in and of itself reflects in part, indisputably, an environment of deep distrust fueled by conspiracy theories, not backed by widely accepted peer-reviewed science, fomented by the very head of DHHS. That shooting happened on August 8th, where a gunman fired hundreds of bullets at the CDC's Atlanta headquarters, killing a police officer before fatally shooting himself. But, you know, it's not the guns. So I want to read a bit of the resignation letter because it is simply shocking. This is the resignation letter issued or sent yesterday by one of these four scientists who quit. And it is shocking. So here are some portions of that for you to consider. I find the views of Mr. Kennedy and his staff challenge my ability to continue in my current role at the agency and in the service of the health of the American people. Enough is enough. I have never experienced such radical non-transparency, nor have I seen such unskilled manipulation of data to achieve a political end rather than serve the good of the American people. You have put people of dubious intent and more dubious scientific rigor in charge of recommending vaccine policy. Their desire to please a political base will result in death and disability of vulnerable children and adults. I'm going to read that line again. Their desire to please a political base will result in death and disability of vulnerable children and adults. We are 7 months into the new administration, and no CDC subject matter from my center has ever briefed the secretary. I am not sure who the secretary is listening to, but it is certainly not to us. Unvetted and conflicted outside organizations seem to be the sources HHS use over the gold standard science of the CDC and other reputable sources. I am resigning because of the cowardice of a leader that cannot admit that his and his minions' words over decades created an environment where violence like this can occur. I reject he and his colleagues' thoughts and prayers and advise they direct those to people that they have not actively harmed. When we come back, we talk Packers. This is the Civic Media Radio Network.
You're listening to Civic Media. Find the latest news, information, and archives of all your favorite shows on the Civic Media website, civicmedia.us.
Welcome back, everybody. I'm Maggie Dawn. You're listening to The Maggie Dawn Show here on the Civic Media Radio Network. We're going to get to the blockbuster trade by the Packers in just a moment, but we have some additional breaking news for you as it relates to the CDC. GOP Health Committee Chair Bill Cassidy. So this is a Republican. This is a Republican that voted to confirm RF Kennedy Jr. as the Secretary of Health and Human Services. He also happens to be a doctor. GOP Health Committee Chair Bill Cassidy is calling for the CDC's vaccine advisors meeting to be postponed, saying this, quote, "If the meeting proceeds, any recommendations made should be rejected as lacking legitimacy given the seriousness of the allegations and the current turmoil in CDC leadership." He went on to say, "These decisions directly impact children's health, and the meeting should not occur until significant oversight has been conducted. If the meeting proceeds, any recommendations made should be rejected as lacking legitimacy given the seriousness of the allegations," as I just read. This is a big deal. Bill Cassidy voted for Mr. Kennedy based on what the representative said was, again, the commitment from RFK to preserve the childhood vaccination schedule, to follow science. He said he got guarantees from RFK Jr. So much for that. I also wanted to just share this. Dr. Hurry, one of the people that has resigned in the last 24 hours from the CDC, in her resignation letter wrote this, quote, "For the good of the nation and the world, the science at CDC should never be censored or subject to political pauses or interpretations. Vaccines save lives. This is an indisputable, well-established scientific fact." By the way, when you put nincompoops in charge of businesses or, you know, massive public health agencies or the Department of Defense, this is what happens. All the smart people leave because it's really hard to work for a moron. With that, let us turn the page. I'm really happy to be joined by my colleague and sports journalist, Mike Clemens. Hey, Mike, how you doing?
Pretty good, Maggie. We're at Lambeau Field, where tonight is the Packers Hall of Fame induction banquet, and they're about to induct Mark Murphy, who after 17 years stepped down at the mandatory age of 70 as the Packers president and CEO. All kinds of good stuff that happened during his era, revenue-wise and, you know, positioning the team. Now, there had been this rumor that, you know, Micah Parsons, who is the leading pass rusher of the Cowboys, he gets like a dozen quarterback sacks every year, about 26 years old, wanted a new contract with the Cowboys, and Jerry Jones had a deal in March, but it wasn't up to what the player wanted, and the two have seemed to split, and the Packers are trading away two first-round picks and one of their veteran players, a leader, a defensive end, just like Parsons, Kenny Clark, to Dallas for Micah Parsons. This is just stunning news. And I happened to be with Mark Murphy when the news broke.
No kidding.
A little press conference. Yeah, a little press conference. We were talking about his career and about the things that they were going to say during his presentation speech tonight. And then this thing broke, and we said, are you where the team is now? It's official. They have. He goes, he didn't know. He's been retired for a month.
Oh, my goodness.
His face kind of frowned, and he said, What did they get? Looks like 2 first-round picks and a player to be named, which Leonard turned out to be Kenny Clark. I don't know anything about that. I'll wait to comment before that's confirmed. And then he finished his press conference talking about his career and everything, and then he walked straight to the office like, what the hell?
I'm sure he did. While I'm in front of the press corps, Mike, 2 first-round picks, Kenny Clark. What do you think of the trade?
Brian Goodikins is a Ted Thompson guy, which means conservative, which means, you know, just give away two. You don't give away 2 or 3 players for 1 other player. You know, they don't like to do that. But in terms of where does this rank in terms of the history of the franchise, it's right up there. It's right up there with 30 years ago, giving away a first-round pick for a third-string quarterback from the Falcons. That turned out to be Brett Favre. It turned out to be aggressive at the start of free agency and somehow wooing Reggie White to Green Bay, a few years after that. This is right up there. So we'll see how it plays out. He's a hell of a player. Teams have to plan for him as a pass rusher, as a defensive foe. But I wonder, is this the start of the new president and CEO, the Ed Policy era, saying, come on, Brian, let's do it?
Yeah, I was going to say, this doesn't read conservative to me, Mike. This reads very aggressive. Any news about what Micah's contract looks like?
4 years, $188 million.
Boy, I'd sign that deal, friend. I mean, holy heck, 4 years, $188 million. Wow.
Goody and his vice president of finance, Russ Ball, getting this deal done in the office just in time so they can get downstairs and join their wives for the dinner, which is about to start here in just a couple of minutes. I mean, how's that for a day at the office?
How is that for a day at the office, and such a day at the office for Micah Parsons? Christmas coming early in the Parsons family, it sounds like. Plus, who doesn't want to play for Green Bay? I know some people claim the Cowboys are America's team, and I have always said, no way. That's the Green Bay Packers. Of course it is.
And the Packers play the Cowboys in about 6 weeks down in Dallas. Appreciate you, Maggie. Appreciate your show.
Appreciate you, Mike. You take care. Folks, that's going to do it for me. Pete Schwab is up with Nightlight. You're going to want to hang around. Remember, I'll stand up for you. I hope you stand up for me. But it is always better when we stand together.
The national news cycle never stops, but it can be hard to find news about your local community. Civic Media is dedicated to providing quality local and state news coverage across Wisconsin. With the Civic Media app, you can get notifications about local stories that matter to you and your community. Find the free Civic Media app in your phone's app store and choose notifications from the menu to tell us what kind of news you want to hear about.